Okay, so we are at chapter 6, page 335, and the synthesis of the disciplines of knowledge. We got so far. The page numbering is sometimes different as according to the edition of the book, but in the new edition is 335. And it has chapter 6, the synthesis of the disciplines of knowledge. So I begin, and you have to endure my non-English accent. I'm sorry for that. If you can
Did we
decide.
already do a meditation, Marco?
Right. I was within the minute. And we are, that also makes part of every session, a beginning meditation, and also at the end, 2 minutes usually. And General Robert usually has our little bands. Do you? Or Chapter 6, the synthesis of the disciplines of knowledge. In the last chapter, we have spoken of renunciation in its most general scope, even as we spoke of concentration in all its possibilities. What has been said applies therefore equally to the path of works and the path of devotion as to the path of knowledge. For in all three, concentration and renunciation are needed, though the way and spirit in which they are applied may vary. But we must now turn more particularly to the actual step of the path of knowledge on which the double force of concentration and renunciation must aid us to advance. Practically, this path is a rescent up to the great ladder of being down which the soul has descended into the material existence.
The central aim of knowledge is the recovery of the self, of our true self-existence. And this aim presupposes the admission that our present mode of being is not our true self-existence. No doubt we have rejected the trenchant solutions which cut the knot of the riddle of the universe. We recognize it neither as a fiction of material appearance created by force, nor as an unreality set up by the mind, nor as a bundle of sensations, ideas, and results of idea and sensation, with a great void or great blissful zero behind it to strive towards as our true truth of eternal non-existence. We accept the self as a reality and the universe as a reality of the self, a reality of its consciousness and not of mere material force and formation. But nonetheless, or rather all the more for that reason, a reality. Still, though the universe is a fact and not a fiction, a fact of the divine and universal, not a fiction of the individual self, our state of existence here is a state of ignorance, not the true truth of our being. We conceive of ourselves falsely. We see ourselves as we are not. We live in a false relation with our environment because we know neither the universe nor ourselves for what they really are, but with an imperfect view founded on a temporary fiction which the soul and nature have established between themselves for the convenience of the evolving ego. And this falsity is the root of a general perversion, confusion, and suffering, which besiege at every step both our internal life and our relations with our environment. Our personal life and our communal life, our commerce with ourselves and our commerce with our fellows, are founded on a falsity and are therefore false in their recognized principles and methods. Although through all this error, a growing truth continually seeks to express itself. Hence the supreme importance to the man of knowledge, not what is called the practical knowledge of life, but of the profoundest knowledge of the self and nature on which alone a true practice of life can be founded. And there's a footnote there with some Sanskrit terms, atmajnana and tattvajnana. I guess that's the self and nature.
I have a quick question. I don't actually need an answer now, but this is one that's been reflecting on deeply the last few weeks. I happened to hear over the course of several days two of the major integral yoga speakers disparage the whole idea of self-realization. That's part of the old yogas. It's not relevant for us anymore. So I put in the chat a comment from Ramana Maharshi's basic, "Who am I?" Once you let go of the mind and body, you are awareness. This to me is pretty much what Sri Aurobindo calls the immutable self. So I just want to put out there, I went through a bunch of the life divine and a bunch of materialism. Sri Aurobindo and the mother both seem to say in absolutely no uncertain terms, and Vladimir clarified for me the other day saying, you cannot get to the supramental, you cannot even have devotion if you don't have some sense of what, some knowledge of what you're devoted to, which means the self, the unborn self. So I just want to put it out there, because this whole chapter is about this. My question I'm sort of asking not to be answered rhetorically is, What is the role of this silent realization of the silent self in the larger integral yoga? Just a thought. Is my turn to read next?
No, it's not.
Okay. Turn. Go ahead. Okay.
Does anybody want to respond to that now, or before I continue reading? The error proceeds from a false identification. Nature has created within her material unity separate seeming bodies, which the soul manifested in material nature enfolds, inhabits, possesses, uses. The soul, forgetting itself, experiences only this single knot in matter and says, I am this body. It thinks of itself as the body, suffers with the body, enjoys with the body, is born with the body, is dissolved with the body, or so at least it views its self-existence. Again, nature has created within her unity of universal life separate seeming currents of life which form themselves into a whirl of vitality around and in each body, and the soul manifested in vital nature seizes on and is seized by that current, is imprisoned momentarily in that little whirling vortex of life. The soul, still forgetting itself, says, I am this life. It thinks of itself as the life, craves with its cravings or desires, wallows in its pleasures, bleeds with its wounds, rushes or stumbles with its movements. If it is still mainly governed by the body sense, it identifies its own existence with that of the whirl and thinks, when this whirl is dissipated by the dissolution of the body around which it has formed itself, then I shall be no more. If it has been able to sense the current of life which has formed the vortex, it thinks of itself as that current and says, I am this stream of life. I have entered upon the possession of this body. I shall leave it and enter upon the possession of other bodies. I am an immortal life revolving in a cycle of constant rebirth. Well, I have a slight bit problem with this idea that we possess our bodies. I'm of the incarnated embodied school that we are not in possession of our bodies, but incarnated. Yeah, so anyway, part of my ongoing troubles with some of Sri Aurobindo's ideas.
What is the difference, Jeffrey, Jen, between incarnated and possessed?
Well, possessed is like an object over which one has ownership. I don't think the body is an object separate from itself. Separate. I mean, even if this argument is valid in the way that it's going, still, I don't think one needs to have this idea of ownership over the body, which brings in a whole bunch of other questions that I have difficulties with. But I'm willing to put it to one side and keep going as usual.
Part of the difficulty of reading Sri Aurobindo is that we read him with our habits of thinking about the world and the universe in a particular way. So if I, let me bring the point I was making before, I'll make it very quickly. If I let go of the sense that what I am is limited to a certain location in time and space, I become coeval, first of all, I spread out to incorporate the entire realm of experience, which I wouldn't call the world. Sri Aurobindo makes a point, actually it's common in Buddhism everywhere, that there is no world when we let go of our mental concept. He says this very clearly in Life Divineness, isn't the Gita, but it's an almost universal idea. It's not idealism, it's not any of those, it's not a philosophy. But if I let go of the sense of being located here, like right now, this awareness associated with this mind and body, there's no limit to it. It includes Jeffrey and John and Marco and Francis and this entire room. And there's no body that's localized either. It's also this body is the entire realm of experience. And they aren't separate. So possession, the way he's using it, is the coming into being of this sensory experience, emotional, mental experience, is by a love embrace, the way a lover possesses the other lover. It's not possession like an object, it's like complete intermingling of conscious energy, which is all one ocean of love. It's a really different way of taking it. Just a suggestion to really, you know, it's really different.
Thanks. That helps.
Yeah. I lost track of the order. Is it
Francois? Francois, I think.
Okay.
It's Francis's turn.
Francis. Yeah.
Right.
I want to make a suggestion before you go, Francis. You can arrange your windows in the Zoom window, the different panels in order, just by putting your mouse pointer on them and dragging them. That way you can always see the order yourself. So
okay.
You can drag go ahead.
I'm not quite sure what to do. I see you and whoever's talking, and then I have a little box down here in the bottom.
Yeah, grab your picture of yourself and move it. I never knew that before, John. That's cool.
Okay, move it. Move it where I'm not grabbing it, but
you click over it and hold the mouse button down and then slide.
I'm on an iPad, so I don't have a mouse.
Okay, I see
something now. I see 1, 2, 3, 4 people lined up at the bottom and a main picture up on top.
Yeah, if you're using the speaker view instead of the gallery view. I don't know how it works on an iPad. So
yeah, you have a choice at the top view or something where you can change from gallery to speaker view.
Okay, I see. It says up at top, it says mute, stop video, share contact, participants, and then more.
No, that's not it. It looked like a little grid image somewhere.
Oh, okay. Let me see. Does it say switch to gallery view?
Yeah, switch to gallery view is what you want.
Okay. I just did.
And now you should see 5 little squares with you in one of them. You can reorder them by clicking and sliding, you know, to put Marco first, then John Robert, then me, and then you, so that the order is clear for you.
Marco first, then who next?
John Robert.
And
Jeffrey Jen. And then Francis.
Then do I come before Don?
Yes, you come before Don.
Okay, thank you. And I don't know where we are. I have the book digitally in Kindle.
Yes, we're on page 337.
Can you tell me like what part and what chapter?
Chapter 6, Synthesis of the Disciplines of Knowledge. Page 337, we are on the new edition. I don't know what kind of edition you have.
We're in part 2.
Part 2.
Chapter 6.
Okay.
And then we're about 2 pages in, are we? One, two. We're two pages into that chapter.
I'm sorry I'm being so technologically difficult, but I'm at a place where it says that error proceeds from a false identification.
Next paragraph. But again, nature.
Okay.
That's where you read.
Thank you. But again, nature has created within her mental unity, formed in a universal mind, separate seeming dynamos, as it were, of mentality, constant centers for the generation, distribution, and reabsorption of mental force and mental activity, stations, as it were, in a system of mental telegraphy, where messages are conceived, written, sent, received. Let me do that again. Where messages are conceived, written, sent, received, deciphered, and these messages and these activities of many kinds, sensational, emotional, perceptional, conceptual, intuition, all of which the soul manifests in mental nature, accepts, uses for its outlook on the world, and seems to itself to project and to receive their shock, to suffer or to master their consequence. Nature installs the base of these dynamos in the material bodies she has formed, makes these bodies the ground for her stations, and connects the mental with the material by a nerve system full of the movement of vital currents through which the mind becomes conscious of the material world, and so far as it chooses, of the vital world of nature. Otherwise, the mind would be conscious of the mental world first, and chiefly would only indirectly glance at material. As it is, its attention is fixed on the body and the material world in which it has been starred, and it is aware of the rest of existence only dimly, indirectly, or subconsciously, in the vast remainder itself, with regard to which superficially it has become irresponsive and oblivious. Wow.
It does correspond to our current understanding of how cognition works. Cognition tends to think it owns the whole shop, and in fact, it's just a little twiddle running around on the top somewhere, and all of this stuff is going on around it, and it doesn't know it's there. So, you know, this was written before recent cognitive science, but although I guess he was aware of ongoing science, so.
I would add that when he speaks of vital currents in the mental world, he's talking about things of which modern science has absolutely no conception. So the vital world is actually a universe which is beyond all the multiverses every physicist has ever thought of. And the mental world is, I'm not saying really believe this, I'm just saying it's what he you know, believes. I'm putting it skeptically, you know. There's a mental world, is a universe far, far beyond the vital worlds. So when he's saying, if we were aware of the mental world first, what that means is when you have a really vivid, lucid dream, my Sufi teacher taught this a lot, those dreams are experiences of other worlds. If you can meet people in those worlds. Like, I could meet you in that world, dream world tonight, we can come back and talk about it. I guarantee you, if you mention that to almost any scientist nowadays, they would become livid, you know, with absolute rage. But I know friends, I've had this happen. I know friends who've had this. So I have no doubt that one can meet other people in dreams and come back and talk about it. So it's true, you're right, that this is very much in line with what cognitive science says. And I taught mindfulness of pain. I taught that we're rarely aware of sensations of the body. There's layers of emotional and mental fabrications on top of it. You get rid of those and you actually reduce the pain. But that's only the physical, what Shibuno called the physical consciousness, the tiny surface. He's talking about vast universes of energy, which would make the quantum field seem like a little blip on the radar screen somewhere far below. The soul identifies itself with this mental dynamo or station and says, I am this mind. And since the mind is absorbed in bodily life, it thinks, I am a mind in the living body, or still more commonly, I am a body which lives and thinks. It identifies with the thoughts, emotions, and sensations of the embodied mind, and imagines it because when the body is dissolved, all this will dissolve, itself also will cease to exist. Or it becomes conscious of the persistence of mental personality, and thinks of itself as a mental soul occupying the body, whether once or repeatedly, and returning from earthly living to mental worlds beyond. The persistence of this mental being, mentally enjoying or suffering sometimes in the body, sometimes in the mental or vital plane of nature, it calls its immortal existence. Or else, because the mind is a principle of light and knowledge, however imperfect, and can have some notion of what is beyond, it sees the possibility of a dissolution of the mental being into that which is beyond, some void or some eternal existence, and it says, there I, the mental soul, cease to be. Such dissolution it dreads or desires, denies or affirms, according to its measure of attachment to or repulsion from this present play of embodied mind and vitality. And only mention, now there again, he's saying that these mental worlds I mentioned from the last paragraph, clearly when he says these are worlds we go to after the body dissolves, this is not what cognitive scientists are talking about as the mental field. Again, you know, I always like to talk to skeptics, you know, he may be a lunatic or psychotic or crazy, but just saying this is what he believes. It's different from scientists.
Yeah, and I would also say that also from a personal experience, when he says mental telegraphy, this phenomena today perhaps we would call it telepathy. Do you mean, Don?
Yeah, where is that? Which paragraph does that start with?
This is a paragraph before, where he speaks of mental telegraphy, and at the beginning.
Okay.
The first five lines at the beginning of the paragraph before.
Yeah.
Paragraph you read.
Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah, this is really, in terms of cognitive science, this is huge. So cognitive science. Still, most of it believes that when I'm, what we all have in common. When I'm looking at this cup, you know, light rays bounce off it, optic nerve, all that. Everyone knows that, how that supposedly works. There's a double doctorate. He has a doctorate in physics and molecular biology, and is teaching neuroscience in Spain. Alex Marin Gomez, he is working on a theory of perception. He's working with Rod Hemsel, an Aurobindo philosopher, which is direct contact. Now, how can you have direct contact? Sri Aurobindo describes it beautifully in Life Divine. This is so far, this requires parapsychology. He says that when this image comes to our attention, it's actually a system of what Marco just said, of paranormal. We are already the self. That whatever we see is our own self in reality. So we don't see by means of the body. We think we do. That we already know subliminally, we know the entire universe. And it only comes to consciousness through the body. I'll just say one more thing. There's actually a parapsychologist now. He's come up in the last few years with the most universally accepted theory of parapsychology. There's a field, a subliminal field, in which we're all united, and we perceive everything at that field first, and only when it comes to because we're stuck, just as Sri Aurobindo says, if we identify with the body, we're not aware of that field. And so we only become aware when it gets processed by the brain. This theory is said to explain virtually all of parapsychological experiments. So it's right in line with what Sri Aurobindo was saying here.
Okay. I felt you were against fields because you said it's just a physicalist conception of the, and you hated fields, I thought. You once told me.
As opposed to a mind field, it's a mind field.
Vital fields, mind fields, but they're fields. No?
Right.
It's not, you see, it's not just a physicalist idea.
No, but you got me, Marco.
Yeah. no, the only little thing that I wanted to say about the mental telegraphy, that I don't have these experiences of telepathy directly, but it happens over and over again that I have an idea and I say, oh, what a great idea that I had. Oh, this is a really wonderful idea. And then in 24 hours, 48 hours, I see on the news someone who is talking about that idea. And this happens so often that I now realize that we don't have our ideas, not our ideas. We catch them in the atmosphere probably, and then believe that's our idea. In reality, this idea perhaps is quite old, and it's nothing new. And I think this is something that happens at a very subtle level, not something that official or at least normal, whatever that might mean, cognitive science would accept at least.
I'll have to talk later. I'm coughing. Go ahead.
So I would say, let's finish this chapter for today, and then let me go ahead. Now, all this is a mixture of truth and falsehood. Mind, life, matter exists, and mental, vital, physical individualization exists as facts in nature, but the identification of the soul with these things is a false identification. Mind, life, and matter are ourselves only in this sense that they are principles of being which the true self has evolved by the meeting and interaction of soul and nature in order to express a form of its one existence as the cosmos. Individual mind, life, and body are a play of these principles which is set up in the commerce of soul and nature as a means for the expression of that multiplicity of itself of which the one existence is eternally capable and which it holds eternally involved in its unity. Individual mind, life, and body are forms of ourselves insofar as we are centers of the multiplicity of the one, universal mind, life, and body are also forms of ourself because we are that one in our being. I read this sentence. Individual mind, life, and body are forms of ourselves insofar as we are centers of the multiplicity of the one, universal mind, life, and body. I don't get the meaning of this. I'm sorry. Individual mind, life, and body are forms of ourselves insofar as we are centers of the multiplicity of the one. Universal mind, life, and body are also forms of ourself because we are that one in our being. Oh, okay. But the self is more than universal or individual mind. Life and body. And when we limit ourselves by identification with these things, we found our knowledge on a falsehood. We falsely our determining view and our practical experience, not only of our self-being, but of our cosmic existence, of our individual activities. From the grammatical point of view, I did not understand the thing.
But you misread it. Was we falsify that in that last sentence? Not we falsely, but we falsify. That makes sense.
Yeah, now I see it. Okay, thank you, Geoffrey Jen. So I read it again. But the self is more than universal individual mind, life, and body. And when we limit ourselves by identification with these things, we found our knowledge on a falsehood. We falsify our determining view and our practical experience, not only of our self-being, but of our cosmic existence and of our individual activities. Now I get it. Thank you, Jeffrey.
So before I read, I just wanted to mention that I just read a story called The Egg. And it's a very beautiful, simple story that in a very simple sense describes what Sri Aurobindo is talking about here.
What's it called?
The Egg.
The Egg. Who is it by?
Let me look.
All right. That's okay. You can get it later.
It's by Andy Weir, Weir.
The guy who wrote The Martian. Probably. It's the same guy.
I just became familiar with him. So he has written some other things, some other interesting sounding things. The self is an eternal, utter being and pure existence of which all these things are becomings. From this knowledge, we have to proceed. This knowledge we have to realize and make it the foundation of the inner and outer life of the individual. The yoga of knowledge, starting from this primary truth, has conceived a negative and positive method of discipline by which we shall get rid of these false identifications and recoil back from them into true self-knowledge. The negative method is to say always, I am not the body, so as to contradict and root out the false idea, I am the body, to concentrate on this knowledge, and by renunciation of the attachment of the soul to the physical, get rid of the body sense. We say again, I am not the life. And by concentrating on this knowledge and renunciation of attachment to the vital movements and desires, get rid of the life sense. We say finally, I am not the mind, the motion, the sense, the thought. And by concentration on this knowledge and renunciation of the mental activities, get rid of the mind sense. When we thus constantly create a gulf between ourselves and the things with which we identified ourselves, their veils progressively fall away from us, and the self begins to be visible to our experience. Of that, then, we say, I am that, the pure, the eternal, the self-blissful. And by concentrating our thought and being upon it, we become that and are able finally to renounce the individual existence and the cosmos. Another positive method belonging rather to the Raja Yoga is to concentrate on the thought of the Brahman and shut out from us all other ideas, so that this dynamo of mind shall cease to work upon our external or varied internal existence. By mental cessation, the vital and physical play also shall fall to rest in an eternal samadhi, some inexpressible, deepest trance of the being in which we shall pass into the absolute existence.
This discipline is evidently a self-centered and exclusive inner movement which gets rid of the world by denying it in thought and shutting the eyes of the soul to it in vision. But the universe is there as a truth in God, even though the individual soul may have shut its eyes to it. And the self is there in the universe really and not falsely, supporting all that we have rejected, truly immanent in all things, really embracing the individual in the universal, as well as embracing the universe in that which exceeds and transcends it. What shall we do with this eternal self in this persistent universe, which we see encompassing us every time we come out of the trance of inner meditation? The ascetic path of knowledge has its solution and its discipline for the soul that looks out on the universe. It is to regard the immanent and all-encompassing and all-constituting self in the image of the ether, in which all forms are, which is in all forms, of which all forms are made. In that ether, cosmic life and mind move as the breath of things, an atmospheric sea of the ethereal, and constitute from it all these forms. But what they constitute are merely name and form and not realities. The form of the pot we see is a form of earth only and goes back into the earth. Earth, a form resolvable into the cosmic life of movement that falls to rest in that silent, immutable ether. Concentrating on this knowledge, rejecting all phenomenon and appearance, we come to see the whole as an illusion of name and form in the ether that is Brahman. It becomes unreal to us, and the universe becoming unreal, the immanence becomes unreal. And there is only the self upon which our mind has falsely imposed the name and form of the universe. Thus are we justified in the withdrawal of the individual self into the absolute.
Still, the self goes on with its imperishable aspect of immanence, its immutable aspect of divine envelopment, its endless trick of becoming each thing and all things, our detection of the cheat and our withdrawal to do not seem to affect one tittle, either the self or the universe. Must we not then know also what it is and thus persist superior to our acceptance and rejection and too great, too eternal to be affected by it? Here too, there must be some invincible reality at work, and the integrity of knowledge demands that we shall see and realize it. Otherwise, it may prove that our own knowledge and not the Lord in the universe was the cheat and the illusion. Therefore, we must concentrate again and see and realize also this which persists so sovereignly, and must know the self as no other than the Supreme Soul, which is the Lord of nature, the upholder of cosmic existence, by whose sanction it proceeds, whose will compels its actions, and determine its perpetual cycles. And we must yet concentrate once again and see and realize and must know the self as the one existence who is both the soul of all and the nature of all, at once Purusha and Prakriti, and so able both to express himself in all these forms of things and to be all these formations. Otherwise, we have excluded what the self does not exclude, and made a willful choice in our knowledge. Wow, this stuff blows my mind, actually. Every sentence or two, he just is presenting these powerful ideas one after another. And wow.
That's the whole story of the reading all along.
There's a really nice, I find very practical teaching. My friend Lot Kelly is one of the non-dual teachers. Sribino describes here, to regard the immanent, all-encompassing, all-constituting self in the image of the ether, the space. So he refers to spacious awareness. And he teaches people first, become aware of spacious awareness. So you begin to become aware, as the mind quiets, of a sort of vast silence encompassing everything. Then he says, become aware from space. And there's this shift that happens. He actually teaches it to beginners. And people usually find that you can have a glimpse of it, that you become aware of this. Like, I'm here, I'm Don. I'm aware of this all-encompassing spaciousness. And just for a moment, you can glimpse, this goes back to what I was saying to Jeffrey before, that this concept of a body and world and things, when you become aware from space, it embraces everything. It completely permeates everything and everyone. And it doesn't have to. He's from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, Dzogchen, which is not one that rejects things. So I recommend strongly, it's a wonderful thing to contemplate. To if you get a sense of quietness and openness and spaciousness, and this, you don't do it by effort. You sort of notice, oh, there's a spaciousness that pervades and seems to constitute. It permeates. It's the substance of everything. Anyway, you can't think about it too much or it won't make sense. Okay.
When I was about 5 years old, I had a deep mystic experience, a spiritual experience, however you describe it. And I was looking at this toy horse that where you flip it back and forth, it makes a movement that happened to be what I was doing. And it was almost as if it put me in a trance. And so in one instant, I was like this little 5-year-old boy. And then the next instance, my consciousness expanded. Just, I can't even contain now how far it expanded. And so while I was having, and this happened just in an instant, and I knew in an instant, I just knew in my body, my mind, intuition, I didn't have to think it out. I didn't have to have logic. And one of the things that I become very aware of is, and this, he goes even deeper, but all we've been talking about is that we as human beings are so focused on objects. So we see people and things and cars and TV news, and it's all going out there, just boom, 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 all this stuff. So we're seeing objects all the time. It's like it was right in front of our face. That's all we're seeing. But while I was having this experience, all that kind of receded back. It's like it become very, and I saw that what the real reality was, and you talk about a space or ether, I saw it as kind of like a glue, what was connecting everything. And that's the profound reality, that field that is connecting everything. Right. And that I felt very identified with that. I knew while I was having it that I was one with everyone who had ever lived and everyone who would ever live. I just felt, I don't know how to explain it, but like I was literally as much each one of you guys as I am myself. I wasn't just, you know, we were all like one in our deepest soul level and this field connecting.
Yeah, that's beautiful. You know, come back to cognitive science. If you got hooked up to a brainwave monitor and you shift your attention from objects to space, beta waves immediately shift into alpha. And if you stay with it, and you'll actually generate gamma, the highest frequency, gamma waves. And just one sentence, and I'll read. Les Femy was a physiologist, yes, psychologist. For 50 years, only thing he taught was to shift from object to spacious awareness and to integrate them. He was able to eliminate in people severe anxiety, depression, chronic pain, relationship problems, and even trained Olympic athletes this way. It's very remarkable stuff. Okay. The old ascetic path of knowledge.
This is one way, but can also go the other way.
Francis, we just lost Marco.
Yeah, he started to break up there just before he left. So he'll have to come back in.
Wait,
yeah. Yeah, we'll wait. He'll be a couple of minutes and come back.
Sure. Am I talking? And it's my first day. I realize I'm talking a lot. I apologize if it's not the normal.
Oh, we all, you know, we all jump in with our different.
Okay.
You know, so. I think it's perfectly part of the whole thing.
I also wanted to ask Jeffrey Jen, are you part Irish?
No. Okay. I might be hearing. Welsh. Okay. Probably. Okay.
Thought I was hearing that. Marco, are you back?
Yeah, I'm the only one who was lost here in the spaciousness, right?
You're in the mental You're in the mental world. Come back.
Yeah, I see. But I don't see you. Do you see me?
No,
we do not.
We don't see you.
But that's strange because my webcam works and I see myself. So the video stream is going on. And the recording, is it working? Yes, it's continued to work. But do you see you among yourself?
Yeah, we see ourselves. Yeah. We just don't see you.
Let me see. Do you see me now?
Vital plane. You're in the vital plane.
Yeah. No. Supramental plane, of course. Please. Huh? Don't. So I don't know what to do because I don't see you.
Try dropping off and coming back. It's the only thing I can do.
Yeah. I hope. But if I leave, does it...
Yeah, okay, it's okay this way. I mean, you know, we can hear you. Oh, we can't hear you. Are you still there?
It went mute, it looks like.
Yeah. Does he know he's muted? Well. Marco, if you can hear us, we can't hear you now. Ah, there we go.
Oh,
now we have
two Marco Masses.
Neither of which we can see. Yeah.
He's now in both the mental and physical worlds. And super mental also.
Do you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I was saying this is not only supramental, but it's also bilocation.
Right.
So, yeah. But the other Marco Masi, who he does not obey to my instructions. So I don't know what to do because the recording is going on, but I suspect that now we have three recordings. Someone has.
No, I don't think the recording broke. It kept going. The host switched to Don when you dropped off, Marco.
Okay.
And I think the recording just kept going, so...
Looks like it, yeah, it's still recording.
So it's just, we can't see you, but that's fine. It's... Yeah.
Okay, then let's leave it there so we can continue this way.
Yep. Sure, I'll go on.
Okay, so who was next now? Mr. Reading, let's finish this chapter, I would say.
Yeah, no? I'm next?
Yeah, Don is next.
Okay. Go ahead, Don. Is next, yeah. Okay.
The old ascetic path of knowledge admitted the unity of things and the concentration on all these aspects of one existence, but it made a distinction and a hierarchy. The self that becomes all these forms of things is a virat, or universal soul. The self that creates all these forms is Hiranyagarbha, the luminous or creatively perceptive soul. Right. The self that contains all these things involved in it is prajna, the conscious cause or originally determining soul. Beyond all these is the absolute who permits all this unreality, but has no dealings with it. Into that we must withdraw and have no farther dealings with the universe, since knowledge means the final knowledge, therefore these lesser realizations must fall away from us or be lost in that. But evidently, from our point of view, these are practical distinctions made by the mind which may have a value for certain purposes, but no ultimate value. Our view of the world insists on unity. The universal self is not different from the perceptive and creative, nor the perceptive from the causal, nor the causal from the absolute, but it is one self-being which has become all becomings, and which is not any other than the Lord who manifests himself as all these individual existences, nor the Lord any other than the sole existing Brahman, who verily is all this that we can see, sense, live, or mentalize. That self, Lord Brahman, we would know that we may realize our unity with it, and with all that it manifests, and in that unity we would live. For we demand of knowledge that it shall unite. The knowledge that divides must always be a partial knowing, good for certain practical purposes. The knowledge that unites is the knowledge.
Therefore, our integral yoga will take up these various disciplines and concentrations, but harmonize and, if possible, fuse them by a synthesis which removes their mutual exclusion. Not realizing the Lord and the All only to reject them for silent self or unknowable absolute, as would an exclusively transcendental, nor living for the Lord alone or in the All alone, as would an exclusively theistic or exclusively pantheistic yoga, the seeker of integral knowledge will limit himself neither in his thought nor in his practice nor in his realization by any religious creed or philosophical dogma. He will seek the truths of existence in its completeness. The ancient disciplines he will not reject, for they rest upon eternal truths, but he will give them an orientation in conformity with his aim.
We must recognize that our primary aim in knowledge must be to realize our own supreme self more than that self in others, or as the Lord of nature, or as the All. For that is the pressing need of the individual, to arrive at the highest truth of his own being, to set right its disorders, confusions, false identifications, to arrive at its right concentration and purity, and to know and mount to its source. But we do this not in order to disappear into its source, but so that our whole existence and all the members of this inner kingdom may find their right basis, may live in our highest self, live for our highest self only, and obey no other law than that which proceeds from our highest self and is given to our purified being without any falsification in the transmitting mentality. And if we do this rightly, we shall discover that in finding this supreme self, we have found the self, we have found the one self in all, the one Lord of our nature and of all nature, the All of ourselves, who is the All of the universe. For this that we see in ourselves, we must necessarily see everywhere, since that is the truth of his unity. By discovering and using rightly the truth of our own being, the barrier between our individuality and the universe will necessarily be forced open and cast away. And the truth that we realize in our own being cannot fail to realize itself to us in the universality, which will then be ourself. Realizing in ourselves the I am he of the Vedanta, we cannot but realize in looking upon all around us the identical knowledge on its other side, thou art that. We have only to see how practically the discipline must be conducted in order that we may arrive successfully at this great unification. End of chapter 6.
I had two things I wanted to say. This is for Jeffrey in terms of reading Sri Aurobindo. So it took me from the mid-70s to the mid-90s, 20 years, to get this. And this is 25 years ago, I barely got this. But a few sentences before the end, he has a sentence, we find the supreme self, the one self in all, the one Lord of nature and all nature. And if I read that as if he's talking about things, well, there's a self, and there's Lord, and there's nature, I'm never going to understand Sri Aurobindo. It's like talking about the self possessing the body, as if there's a self and a body. And I find, to whatever extent there's a feeling for it, that he said, there's a disciple, Pavitra, who wrote a simple book on meditation. He says, if you want one thought to carry you through the entire yoga, it's that of God and all in God. Now, if you think of God and all as separate or things, that doesn't help either. But if you want something sort of abstract or impersonal, like there is this divine consciousness which is vibrating in everything, and a silence which pervades everything, and they're not two. That whenever I find to this day, when I start reading Sri Aurobindo, I can feel my mind starting to grab on to these words as objects. If I let go of all that and come back to whatever sense there is of this combined silence, pervading silence, and combined field, there's a field again, of undulating, alive, vibrant energy, it kind of dissolves all that sense of thingness which my mind can get into. So
I do understand that reading Aurobindo. I mean, it's just that I have my critical faculties and they come forward, whether they like, you know, even though I get the broader ideas. Yeah. And the whole point of this exercise is to, I don't know, allow our critical faculties to come forward and talk about them in a group and see where that takes us, right? I mean, I agree. It's clearly, I mean, every time you read one text of Sri Aurobindo, you kind of have to have all the others in the background.
I also wanted to add, because Zoom censored me previously, but since you take it up again, do you hear me? Don, you make a strange face and just guess.
Yeah, we can see you now. We can see you since Hiranya Garba and the luminous.
You see.
That's where you came back in.
was all programmed, no, because when you said seeing the spaciousness, yes, but that's fine. But this is one way of seeing the spaciousness in which things are immersed into. But I can see also the other way around, which is not in contradiction, but it's complementary to that way of seeing, where you see the spirit in things emerging into that spaceness. And if you are able to do these two things together, then we have probably something that goes more in the direction of what Sri Aurobindo is talking here about.
I agree completely.
Because if we do only one thing, if we see only the spirit in the objects, I suspect it might be hijacked by the vital, because you see a lot of the world becomes to look sketchy. However, if you do this the other way around, where you have the spaciousness and you don't see the spirit in the object, it can become something very dry, where the world nevertheless is immersed in this powerful silence, and yet some life missing, no? Almost dead, dry. So yeah, it must be these two ways of perceiving and living reality must be complemented together. It's not easy, but I think it's needed.
What you say is so interesting. So, you know, I'll tell for other people. The last 2 years, Jan and I studied with a non-dual teacher named Andrew Hewson. Andrew was in jail at 25 he had fallen asleep on some kind of pills. And for vehicular manslaughter, his car ran into him. He was actually hanging a rope ready to kill himself. And he had this opening to pure awareness, that spacious awareness. And he progressively went to unity and beyond that to the power of Brahman. Now, I won't say anything more about him. He was very mixed and has a lot of vital problems. But he did see these gradations very clearly. And he said he's been talking to non-dual teachers around the world. And many have gotten stuck. They get to this opening of the spacious awareness. Yeah. That's it. And the world is very dead. It's meaningless. It's kind of empty. They're big on no self. There's no self. It's all meaningless. Do what you want. See how the vital can make use of that. And he said his experience was pure awareness. He's been meeting many people, tends to be women more often, whose first awakening is to the presence in things. It's very personal and devotional, and the pure awareness tends to be somewhat masculine and dry, but he teaches very much, his whole teaching, which I think is beautiful, is a sacred marriage. That before we can even recognize the power of Brahman, we need to have the sacred marriage of the pure, just what you said. It's beautiful.
What is his name?
Andrew Hewson. I don't recommend him. He's very problematic in many ways, but okay. He does have a certain genius for certain areas.
Okay. Oh, we will.
It's not the race car driver. There's S-E-N and S-O-N. He's S-O-N.
S-O-N, yeah.
Yeah, I would like to.
That's no problem. Go ahead, Francis.
I would like a comment to go back. I want to reread one, maybe a paragraph back. But we're talking about so many things, and I kind of used the term that Sri Aurobindo is mind blowing. You know, he's talking about a transcendent self, and in the, you know, and how do we handle all this stuff? And it's almost. But I'm going to read just one little sentence here. The pressing need of the individual to arrive at the highest truth of his own being. So what the highest truth within us. And then in the way that kind of simplifies it, we don't have to figure everything else out. We don't have to arrive at this cosmic knowing. Just keep seeking for that, the highest truth in your own being. Just find that helpful.
Yeah. It's not a mental search. It is a spiritual, yeah, spiritual in the sense of Sri Aurobindo's meaning. Because spiritual means something, chakras over the head. Psychic is the chakra of the heart. It's a sort of distinction that you make before Don to female and male.
Right.
Yeah, there are probably also, that would be also an interesting topic. Why men have more and female in women and other types of experiences. But
yeah,
and I don't digress.
That's a very, you know, rigid. It's just saying it happens to be that way. It's not.
Anyway. Yeah, no. Of course, it's not necessarily one way.
I appreciated your comment, Francis. One of the things that we try to do with these readings and is to, because the idea of doing this reading of the Synthesis of Yoga is to focus on it as a guide for practical life. And so we try to, you know, you can get very theoretical sometimes, but mm-hmm. try to bring it back to how does this apply to our everyday lives? And I think your comment, Francis, about the pressing need of the individual takes us to the individual life as a, so there's a kind of an entrance point there as well. I mean, I'm not saying there are lots of other ones here too.
Sure.
But it's that reflection that we're also trying to do here.
Yeah. And I see that in the reading him, Sri Aurobindo's so broad and expansive and covers so many different areas and different types of yogas, and it just can be, but yet there's this element of, he brings it back to a very practical way. Now, how are you going to do it in your life?
I'm curious what other people think about this, because Sri Aurobindo doesn't talk about this traditional Vedantic notion very often, that you already, he does mention it later in Synthesis, that, you know, we think when we read the pressing need of the individual, this is in terms of very practical, we think, okay, I'm Don, and I need to find my higher self, right? And he does point out later beautifully, he said, in truth, we already are the high, we are that. Right? And so the idea of becoming that can be practically one of the greatest obstacles. So rather than thinking, I need to become, he says, actually take the words, we need to realize our Supreme Self, right? Realize doesn't mean become, figure out, or even, you know, shift to. It means we are that, but it's not quite real to our consciousness. And so every time we have, to me, I find this helpful all day long. Every time there's a moment of opening, I consider that a grace, because I'm also very devotional. So I consider that a grace. Like, you know, you can literally, if it's your orientation, you can say, thank you, Mother. You may have a moment of silence. You know, I felt a little sort of leap of joy first signing into this. I've loved Synthesis of Yoga. I read it every day from 2013 to 2020. And, I've never been in a group, Synthesis of Yoga, how wonderful. And there's a little bit of opening, a sense of beauty and a sense of a smile permeating everything. It felt like a little glimpse of something higher. And it wasn't by doing. I didn't do that by effort. It just came, right? It's no credit to Don. And so I can sort of have a little gratitude. Thank you. And it seems like every time that's acknowledged, she, the mother, you know, becomes more present.
The pressing need of the individual also brings to mind the pressing stones from the Vedas, you know, which is another sense of the pressing. So I think there's, you know, Sri Aurobindo was aware of his own, right? I don't know which was written first, but the pressing stones is a different sense of pressing than the pressing need. It's the pressing as a process of purification, right? So there's something going on here that may be there as well.
That makes sense. Well, he's even talking about purification afterwards. He's right in that same sentence. To set right disorders, confusions, false identifications. That's purification.
No.
Yeah. There you go.
Yes, false identification. I think that we can also learn from those teachers of whom Sri Aurobindo is very critical of, these purely Vedantic, dry teachers who, they see only one part of the truth, so to speak. But when you say, for example, there is nothing to become, this is a typical Vedantic expression. Don't try to become something or to just... I don't know now, I cannot paraphrase them exactly. But they say essentially, there's even nothing to realize. Stop trying to do nothing, absolutely nothing. Then you will have this identification. And by the way, this identification is always there. It's only your mind that believes that it is not there. And so sometimes I think it can be also healthy to switch a bit from this too extremely integral view of Sri Aurobindo and go back to a bit more contracted point of view, yogic point of view. But what we can learn also from these masters, I think.
But you know, I've always loved that Vedantic approach, and I've looked for years in Sri Aurobindo. There's a conversation. These things come out more in the conversation. He's not quite so doctrinaire. It's a conversation with a Kapali Shastri, who was a disciple of Maharshi for many years. And he says to him exactly that. He said, there's a silence everywhere. Do not try to find it.
Yeah.
Let go. Relax into it. It will come over you. It's already there. You don't need to find it. So he actually was teaching. You can find a few conversations, like with Pavitra also, where he does exactly this kind of Vedantic teaching. So Sri Aurobindo is very comprehensive. But be careful, Marco. John's listening. He's going to get you kicked out of the cult of Sri Aurobindo for saying things like that. So be careful.
I would not go into another group and saying, I'm not the guy who goes. Yeah. Now it comes to my mind something. I once, in a psychology forum, I once asked if silence can be a form of, can have a therapeutic effect. Huh? What do you think they did? They kicked me out.
They kicked you out?
Yeah.
Was this a Sri Aurobindo forum?
No. A psychology forum. years ago. I don't even remember where it was.
Right.
And I tried to ask the question again, and they censored it again and again. Because why? I don't know. Because probably they thought this is a meaningless question. I don't know. But silence can be also have its therapeutic effects. And I mean, not only the sound, the silence, the inner silence, finding the inner silence that you can have also when you are in a crowd. It's not the acoustic silence that I mean, even though that helps.
The psychiatric answer is, if you are in therapy with a person who's unstable, silence will unsettle them and make them, they even make them psychotic.
This is very interesting. I found many people who get, I mean, I have also friends, but why is that? Okay, you will tell me on Sunday eventually. Because I'm wondering, why does people, they become nervous? And I become nervous if there is no silence. So I'm normally almost always nervous because this inner silence is relatively difficult to catch. And sometimes it comes and it is extremely strong. It is a power. It's not just something passive. And but the sociological aspect I find very interesting. Why do psychologists see this as a meaningless question if silence could be a form of therapy? You might disagree, but don't censor me. Why did this trigger? It triggered something. I don't know what, because they didn't allow me to open a discussion about that, but it was very interesting as a reaction I found.
Well, if you go back to the text, silence, if you're identified with the body, the vital, and the mind, silence is death. It's terrifying.
Yeah, from that point of view, yes. Yeah.
They did an experiment where they put people in a room with nothing to do, no phone, nothing. And there was a buzzer on the table. You could touch it, it would get you electric shock. 70 or 80% of the people not only did it once, but they did it 20. It was so torture. It's a nightmare to be by yourself in silence. They'd rather shock themselves over and over again than just silent.
But because our culture, I think, misinterprets inertia for silence. What they perceive is some sort of passive inertia, not a real silence. Because in the silence, there is power, there is fullness. It is a full emptiness. Buddhists would probably speak in this way, And I don't think that they really, here again, we had this, what Vladimir said the last time, we are using words and mean the very different things.
To get back to what Jeffrey Jen said, if you look at McGilchrist, who talks about the intuitive and analytic forms of attention, this is how I see it. Could be wrong. I've been known to be wrong in my life a few times. Okay. So, we absolutely want to use, Marco's teaching a class on science. I'll be teaching a class on science soon. So, very much hone, refine the analytic skills. But what is our base? Normally we analyze just with analysis and maybe some intuition behind. I think for reading Sri Aurobindo, when you drop back into the silence and open to intuition, and from there, when Francis was saying the Lord and the transcendental, and it sounds like a lot. Remember, he goes on to say, we find our own supreme self, and we discover this supreme self is the one self in all, the one Lord of nature and of all nature. And if we recognize some sense of pervading presence in reality, and from that intuitional sense of pervasiveness, which can't be captured in words, then we to try and critically analyze, well, what does he mean by the one self and all the supreme selves, one Lord? But we don't forget. Oops. Jeffrey didn't like that.
No. Jeffrey Jen, this time it was his turn.
That was like a magician move, Don. You said, we don't forget, and he disappeared.
That was it. He's demonstrating what I was saying.
Well, I just want to say real quick, we've been talking about silence and that value. And like saying the basis of yoga and a lot of different places, Sri Aurobindo said the first thing needed is a quiet mind. So in the practice, to me, and I, that's either he's talking about silence, the very, very close to it. First thing it is a quiet mind. And then very quickly, he follows up on the inner being, the psychic self, opening the heart. Well, it's an integral yoga. He can talk about doing concentration in the head, between the eyebrows, above the head. But he kind of says the preferred way is to have that concentration in the heart. So quiet mind, opening the inner being, opening the heart.
Yeah, and what people sometimes forget is that there is not only the silence of the mind, but also the silence of the vital and the silence of the physical. And it's not a detail. And to obtain that is even more difficult, of course. But sometimes you can have alternatively, you don't have the silence of the mind, but that of the vital. This is also a very curious experience, because if there is no psychic opening, then everything appears quite flat, emotionally. If you have a psychic opening, then it's all like you see the reality with rosy glasses. And even if the mind goes like a monkey, then it destroys this state of silence, sooner or later. But it is possible to have. And so the objective for in the integral yoga, by the way, it's integrality, is also that we have to reach all three types of silence, and probably there are also more types of silences. And that of the body also. In the agenda, sometimes I think you can find some passages where Mother speaks about that. And so what is silence? From the yogic perspective, I think is a quite complex topic, I suspect.
Shall we finish up there with
I would say we finish this.
I'm kind of running out of steam personally, so.
we have finished this chapter, no? We can continue the next
you're
time.
You're muted, Don, I think.
Hope you feel better soon.
Yeah, I hope so too. We normally reread the chapters twice, and Andrea should be back next time. And so it would be a chance for her to read the chapter with us as well. So.
Okay.
Wonderful.
Okay, let's do 2 minutes of the meditation. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Have a nice time.
Bye-bye, everybody. Thank you. See you next time.
Hope to see you all next time.
Thank you.